brauche eine Minute von euch. Wenn ihr diesen Podcast hört und mögt, gehört ihr zu denen, die Marke nicht für Dekoration halten, sondern für einen strategischen Hebel. Doch Markenführung ist heute anspruchsvoller denn je. Mehr Möglichkeiten, mehr Meinungen und auch mehr Hype. Viele Marketeers stehen unter Druck, die richtigen Entscheidungen zu treffen und zu rechtfertigen. Dabei gibt es sie, valide Prinzipien, belegte Erfolgsfaktoren und klare Modelle. Viele Mythen der Markenführung sind empirisch widerlegt. Trotzdem bleiben sie weit verbreitet, verschwenden Budget und verschenken Wirkung. Und aus unzähligen Gesprächen mit Markenverantwortlichen wissen wir, was am meisten fehlt, ist nicht Kreativität, sondern verlässliche Orientierung. Die Fähigkeit, den Hype von Substanz zu unterscheiden und strategische Fragen mit Selbstvertrauen zu beantworten. Genau da setzen wir an. Wenn ihr Inspiration, Orientierung und Entscheidungssicherheit wollt, dann könnt ihr Markenkraft auch live buchen. Als Keynote für euer Event, als Inhouse-Seminar für euer Team oder in unserer zweitägigen Masterclass. Uwe Munzinger und ich geben einen strukturierten Überblick über das, was Markenkraft erzeugt und Marken wachsen lässt. Fundiert, praxisnah und direkt anwendbar. Klingt interessant? Dann findet ihr mehr Infos unter markenkraft.org. Danke für eure Zeit und vielleicht bis bald. Willkommen bei einer neuen Episode von Markenkraft. Für alle, die von Marken fasziniert und für ihr Wohlergehen verantwortlich sind. My name is Olaf Hartmann. Today's episode is about something that sounds almost too simple to be profound. And yet it might be the single most important thing anyone working in marketing needs to hear. My guest today once wrote a sentence on a post-it note that Mark Ritson has since called the most important thought in advertising. It reads, "They really don't give a shit." 5 words, slightly rude. And yet, as we will discover, if you truly internalize what they mean, almost every major mistake in marketing becomes avoidable. The obsession with messaging, the neglect of entertainment, the belief that people process our ads the way we present them in boardrooms, the assumption that our brand is as important to customers as it is to us. All of it falls away once you accept that starting point. But here's the uncomfortable question. If it's so obvious, why does it keep needing to be said? My guest today is Sarah Carter, global planning partner at Adam & Eve TBWA, formerly Adam & Eve DDB. Well, that's a tongue breaker. And before that, BMP, the agency that invented account planning as we know it. Sarah started her career in marketing at Unilever, then joined BMP without fully realizing at the time that she had arrived at the most influential planning department in the world. Over a career spanning 4 decades, Sarah has led communication strategy for some of the world's most celebrated brands. She is co-author, together with Les Binet, of How Not to Plan, 66 Ways to Screw It Up, a book that the planning community has called the Bible of Planning. She has won multiple IPA Effectiveness Awards, including the Grand Prix, and Mark Ritson has publicly called her his favorite advertising thinker of all time, which she modestly suspects had a lot to do with the word shit in her most famous quote. Sarah is someone who always has been interested in the messy and human versus the consumer, the effective versus the fashionable, the humble versus the pompous, and tell it as it is simplicity versus the complex. Sarah, welcome to Markenkraft. It's a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here. What a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Sarah, where did you grow up? Mm. And what was the first money you earned there?
Well, I grew up in rural Norfolk, which is, I don't know how much your listeners would know about this, the sort of bit that sticks out on the east coast of Great Britain. So it's quite a rural area, quite sleepy. I grew up there. Yeah, I went to school there. So the first money I earned, I did waiting at a local kind of restaurant. So I sort of earned money from being a very bad waitress there. I think that would be the first money earned. Wasn't very much.
And the little money you you earned? What did you spend it on? You remember?
It would probably be clothes at the time. There was a shop. The local town was a little town called King's Lynn. Didn't have very interesting shops in it, but there was one called Etam. Doesn't exist anymore. But I used to go there and spend my money in that. I used to go in on the bus. So it felt like the sort of height of glamour, being able to go into King's Lynn and buy my own clothes there. So yeah,
that downtown King's Lynn.
Yeah, how exciting is that? Yeah, so that would be what it was spent on, I think. Yeah.
But it's a beautiful country. I love the north of England.
It is very beautiful.
And then later on, like going to uni or like even during school, like do you remember a moment? Some people don't, but many people do. When was the first moment that you really understood what the concept of brand is all about? Like beyond being exposed to brands, by brands, but first, like you woke up to this concept of, okay.
I can tell you exactly when it was actually. So I did my A-levels at school, and like most people didn't really know what I wanted to do. And so there's a number of kind of, there's probably four lucky moments in my career really. So the first one was a teacher at school told me about this course called Human Sciences, which had only been around for 8 years. It happened to be at Oxford University. It was the only university that did it. So, and I just thought that course sounded brilliant, and I was lucky enough to get in. It wasn't that I wanted to go to Oxford, but I wanted to do this course. And, you know, little did I know at the time, but it was actually, it couldn't have been a better course of planning. I had no idea what planning was at this stage, but it was just everything to do with humans. So it was ethnography and anthropology, sort of human geology, human biology, psychology, statistics. It was literally a planning course. So I was very lucky I did that. But then the second lucky kind of twist in the road, and this is when I first heard about brands, was I think I rocked up one day to a lecture that got cancelled at the human sciences department, and next door was the careers office. And just to kill an hour, I just thought, I'll go in there and see what's going on. And there was a talk by a P&G brand manager on toothpaste. It was Colgate, I think. And that person changed my life, because I had no idea what brands were, never heard of marketing before that. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I actually really liked the sort of academic world of anthropology. And I quite thought I might go on and be an academic in anthropology. And then I sat and listened to this lady for an hour talking about, it was Crest toothpaste, the Crest buyers of toothpaste, why they bought what. And I suddenly, this light bulb went off. I thought, this is like commercial anthropology. I don't have to go and live in a mud hut and study tribes somewhere. I can study the great tribe of the British public.
You can go to downtown Kingsley
and get paid for it, and not have to, you know, and sleep in my bed every night and drink nice cups of tea still, rather than being with some sort of remote tribe somewhere. So that was the light bulb moment. And yeah, who knows what would have happened if I hadn't stumbled on that. So that's what led me to be interested in brands and marketing. And then I was lucky enough to get my job at Unilever. And then the next lucky break was after 3 years at Unilever in marketing. And they did a really good marketing training scheme in those days. I'm sure they still do. But you spent 3 months in the sales force and 3 months with commercial and 3 months in the trade department and 3 months doing kind of research. And the bits of the job I really loved were the research and the working with the ad agencies, and the bits I didn't like so much were negotiating trade discounts on, I was at Bird's Eye Wall, so I was working on fish fingers, negotiating discounts on fish fingers with Tesco buyers. So then I decided I wanted to move into advertising, and I had heard of planning by that stage. Luckily, I got offered, I think, three jobs in planning, one of which was at BNP. As you said in your intro, I had no idea that it was as good as it was, but the people I asked just said, you'd be mad if you don't take the BNP one, because that's where you go to learn about planning. So I ended up working at BNP. That was the third lucky twist. And then the fourth one was that I happened to sit next to Les for a great deal of time while I was working there, and hence became our great long-term friend association.
Okay. Slow down. This is too good. Okay, let's pick this apart a little bit.
Yeah.
Because we have some younger audience, I know, and let's start with the word planning.
Yes.
Yeah. Because I think that it creates a lot of confusion. What is brand planning from
Well, in the days when I joined at BNP, it was known as the sort of voice of the consumer in the agency. That's what it was decided. And basically, our job, BNP planning was different. It invented planning alongside JWT. So we both came up with it at the same time. Our kind of planning was very different in that we had a lot of planners. So basically, we had the same number of planners pretty well as account men. That was unusual. So every account would have a planner and account man sitting side by side. And we used to describe it as the account man was the sort of pilot flying the plane, and then the planner was the sort of navigator, if you like, sitting next to them. And there was a very, very heavy emphasis on planners doing their own primary research, so focus groups in those days. Maybe we'll come on to that, but you know, that whole post-it note, I think, probably comes back to that experience, because as a planner, we would regularly every year go out around Britain in people's homes in those days, because we didn't do them in viewing facilities. I mean, that probably seems quite strange to some of your younger listeners as well. We had a research department at BNP whose sole job was setting up groups, focus groups for the planners to go to. We actually employed three people to do that. So I would regularly do 100 plus groups a year traveling around the country on my brands. We only worked on two or three brands. And we would do everything, the research from, you know, MPD to a lot of ad development work, and then the sort of evaluation work as well. But those sitting in people's homes, real people's homes, you know, a group was an hour and a half long. You do over 100 a year, you have eight people in a group. You've got 800 people that you're speaking to. It really was. I mean, yes, right back to the sitting in mud huts with tribes. It was literally that. And really, you know, I suppose a lot of my philosophy just grows from that, really, because we spent so much time with real people in their homes, on their sofas, you know, talking to them in the kitchens before the people arrived for the groups, you know. So you get such a sort of feeling of context. You weren't just talking about brands, you were out in real people's homes talking about their real lives for hours and hours and hours every year, and then bringing all that knowledge back into the agency to bear on your accounts, you know, for all of that year. So it wasn't just that you were now, you'd commission some qual research, you'd get the findings, and then the researcher goes off and you don't ever see them again. You know, that knowledge would all be still within you that you could bring into your accounts and your brands all the time. So you can see how that kind of consumer in the agency perspective was so kind of profound, really, and was at the heart of all our planning.
And just to do that little detour historically, how was it invented? And how did it differ from all the other agencies that were working? Because you still, many people listening have seen Mad Men and in the 60s. Yes. You see these scenes with consumer interviews behind the one-sided mirror and all that. But what was the concept of brand planning that said we're going to change that?
Well, I think before that, there were a lot of agencies had very big research departments. And a lot of agencies actually were the research departments. You know, clients actually didn't have them, a lot of them in those days. So there would be big research departments, but importantly, sort of often sitting on another floor, and they'd be kind of dipped into for odd projects on brands. But the difference in our planning was the researchers were kind of taken out of the back room, if you like, and put right there side by side with the account directors and meeting clients and working with clients, not kind of kept apart from them, because the sort of research departments classically were sort of backroom research departments. So it was a very active process of ongoing account involvement. And our job was to just be totally versed in everything to do with the brands, the clients, the people. We had all the quant data, we did our own qual. So it was a very heavy research
And you immersed involved. Yourself. That was yes, a difference to before. Exactly. There was before it was commissioned, and yes, then you got back the project based.
Yes.
But this, like, you stayed on the same brand. Yes. You immersed yourself. You did the research yourself. So you created basically something like of an intuition, yes, like the statistics of environment.
Absolutely,
by working,
yeah,
on the brand,
yeah,
for a long time.
Yes, and I mean, okay, profound intuition, but also knowledge, and also more, I mean, usually more knowledge than the clients, because they would change roles, you know, quite significantly. Yep. But actually, so the planners had very, very long and trusted relationships with clients. You know, often clients would move to another company and they'd want the planner to move with them because they, you know, they had so much kind of trust. And so it was a really significant role, and the agency really believed in it and invested in it. And we'll perhaps come on to John Webster, who was one of the main creatives there at the time, but he had this incredibly symbiotic relationship with planning. So planning and John Webster and the way he wrote ads worked hand in hand, and kind of liftoff happened, really.
Okay, we need to do a small twist. Yes. Please introduce John Webster to the German audience, because, yes, yeah, he's a...
Yes,
he's a creative god.
Yes, he is. I mean, yes, if you ask any creative about John Webster, I would hope in the UK, and, you know, yes, even around the world, but certainly with the UK, he would be up there as one of the most influential creatives that there were. I mean, he was the most famous creative. I mean, he wasn't a flamboyant creative character at all. He was actually very quietly spoken, but he had an amazing ability to write ads that were equally loved by the general population, the great British public, and the industry. And that doesn't often happen. He was a fantastic creator of popular advertising that was kind of recited in playgrounds and, you know, talked about in pubs, and but lauded by the industry as well. And he was most famous for creating characters, really. So particularly bears, furry characters. So if your audience look up things like the Cresta bear, the Hofmeister bear, the Sugar Puffs honey monster, which is actually still being used. I mean, he didn't just do character ads. He did one of the creators' sort of favorite ads of all time, which was something called The Points of View for The Guardian, which interestingly, literally this week, The Guardian, which is a newspaper in the UK, have bought back an updated version of John's 40-year-old ad, which is one of the classic ads of all time. So he was.
And they're
just
using one of the characters from,
yes,
that ad,
exactly,
who
right,
has aged and
yes,
continues to speak the story, yeah, to tell the story.
I mean, it is one of the most exquisite pieces of communication of all time. I mean, your listeners should.
I will link it. I will,
yes,
link it. But let's try to describe it. It's, yes, basically a scene on the street, and you see a skinhead running towards a man.
Yes.
And he holds a briefcase. So from one perspective, it looks like he's going to rob him.
Yes.
And then from the other perspective, they seem to wrestle.
Yes.
And the third perspective shows that above him there's a ton of bricks which is about,
yes,
to fall off. And then the story, okay, you really need to see,
yes,
the whole picture.
To see the whole picture, yes. I mean, it was just the most exquisite summing up of the Guardian newspaper's philosophy, which is that it wasn't owned by any kind of press baron. It was a genuinely independent newspaper and gave you the whole unbiased picture. And he just came up with this brilliantly simple idea. I mean, I've actually got the script that he wrote for that. And when you look at it written as a script, it's the most parsed, and there's hardly anything in it. You know, it's so simple. The voiceover is very stripped back. But The Guardian at the time said, we'll never get anything better that more pithily expresses our philosophy as a paper, and clearly they haven't, because they've gone back to it 40 years later, and actually it still looks pretty timeless, doesn't it? It's black and white.
Absolutely.
Interestingly, originally it was meant to have sound effects, but when John got into he was renowned for this, he never stopped kind of crafting all the way up to the end, and when he was in the editing suite, they had sort of shouts and things like that originally, and he turned them off. And suddenly he thought, this is just even better without it, because it has this kind of hypnotic quality. There's no sound at all with what's going on in the street. So, Yes, it's an amazing ad. So, yes, and it's useful to know that he didn't just do furry animal ads. He did do, you know, beautiful.
And it's a good point. What Mark Ritson recently said, and I think it was done with System One, that wear out is a myth. That digging in the archives, you can find true gold, and then you retest these ads, and often they perform better than the current ads.
Yeah.
And especially if you keep them on for a long time, they become better and better and better.
Yes.
And test.
Yeah, that's another whole area of discussion for
us. We talk about that later.
Yeah, let's do that later.
Let's first stay with John. What did you learn from him? If you think of that time, what would be the most,
I think I learned everything from him, really. I mean, I was just, this is one of my sort of, just so lucky, really. I was lucky to end up landing, working at BNP. You all know Paul Feldwick, won't you? Paul Feldwick trained me. My first group discussion I did was with Paul sitting behind the sofa in a sitting room in Bristol. You know, my first focus group that I did was out on the road with Paul. So I was being trained by one of the most brilliant planners there'd been. And it just happened that the accounts I worked on, they all seemed to have John as the creative on it. And that was just luck, because there were lots of other brilliant creatives there as well. But so, you don't realize at the time how much, but I think pretty well everything I learned was from him. And you know, that post-it note directly comes from that, because John, of all people, I mean, we didn't have the science and the research to show it then, but just intuitively understood that you need to be entertaining and that you don't need to be serious and that people don't care about your products. And that was, you know, by and large, because a lot of the products that we had at the time were really not very great products. I mean, his famous Smash Martians, I don't know if you're aware of that. That was for dried potato. I mean, it was a...
Potato powder that you basically put in with milk and then you have a
smashed
potato.
Disgusting thing. Or the Cresta Bear was... Cresta was this sort of frothy drink. I mean, it was full of chemicals, water and chemicals. And
The dark side of marketing now.
If you're working with dried potato or, you know, flavored chemicals, you know, you can't take it terribly seriously or think that these are very profound sort of brands of people's lives, because they're really not. And he knew that because the products weren't very interesting, he had to make them interesting. And actually interesting, if you think of what was happening in the Mad Men era in the States at that time, Burnback over at DDB, I mean, a bit before that, I mean, his great creative ideas tended to be on more glamorous products. So you had, you know, the VW car, you had airlines.
Which wasn't very glamorous at the time. It was super ugly, and it was a Nazi car right after the Second World War, to be fair.
A bit better than dried potato, probably.
That's true.
But you know what I mean? I mean, if you don't have very glamorous products that people aren't very interested in, you're sure as hell going to make the ads sort of pretty interesting, because and he made them entertaining. And all the things that we now know from data makes ads work, which we'll come on to, sort of characters, campaigns, humor, music, you know, he just did all that stuff intuitively, and that's why people loved his ads so much. And I guess all that stuff I've kind of absorbed from him, really, because I was the one taking these ads out to talk to people about them in their sitting rooms, and so you could see how people felt about them.
So what we take from that first bit of our conversation, that people don't give a shit, is not basically to put people down, is they are not important.
Yes.
It's basically changing the view of what they do to make it matter for the people out there that are not interested.
It comes from a deep respect for people, but it's certainly not a criticism on them, that, you know, the things they are interested in are their families, how are they going to afford to feed them that week, why the washing machine's making a funny noise, you know, what's happening in the royal family, what's happening with traitors on TV that week. You know, that's the stuff they care about. They don't care about sort of dried potato, and why should they? So it comes from a position of humility that brands are little things in people's lives, and understanding the things that are important in their lives, and just getting comfortable with our insignificance in people's lives, which is we'll come on to this as well, maybe, but this is where the whole purpose thing went so wrong, I think, because people lost that and thought that things...
We come exactly there, because I wanted to see, like, okay, if we start from the stance of consumer indifference, what changes in our approach to communication? And you just mentioned the word purpose, for example.
Yeah. Well, I think everything changes. I think, as you said, if you get that wrong and start from a position of people care about brands, first of all, you don't have to be entertaining because you feel that they're inherently interested in what you've got to say, which they're not. You feel that you don't need to kind of be entertaining. You can just sort of pump messages at them. You don't pay attention to branding because you think that they're paying attention to your ad, so we'll work out what brand it is. You don't think making it easy to comprehend is important because you feel that they're paying close attention to what you're doing because they're interested, but they're not. And then you sort of often think, well, we'll just chop and change and we'll disrupt it and we'll do one thing and then we'll do another because they care enough to glue it all together and try and make sense of it. And we know that that's not true either. So conversely, if you start from indifference, you make it enjoyable. You make it easy to know who's actually talking to you. You make it easy to process. You make it easy to remember. You just make it easy to do a lot of these things. And you earn people's attention by giving them something back in return, which is making them laugh or telling them something useful or interesting. So as you said in your introduction, just everything goes wrong if you get the start point wrong. And purpose was as a classic example of what can go wrong. You know, we believe these things are important. We believe these values are important. Ergo, we're going to push them at you and never mind, you know, that you've got things that are more important to you. And yeah, it was a bit of a sorry debacle, really, wasn't it?
Mm. We have been misled by some outliers, we have to say.
Yes.
There are some always examples that actually have purpose built into their core of their brand, and they actually benefit from it.
Yes.
And without the purpose, they would be hollow.
Yes.
And everybody else thought, probably maybe also out of a little bit of a feeling, you know, I'm working really in a dirty industry.
Yeah.
I'm not good for this world. I'm
Absolutely.
Just selling some fizzy drinks, which is bad for health.
Yes.
And but doing good marketing and good brand, brand leadership is something very valuable because it keeps people in their jobs also.
Yes.
It protects us against volatile times. Very volatile times. And I think that if you work for a very strong brand, you can be sure that your job is a lot safer than in a company with a weak brand.
No, you're right on all those things. I think Byron said something like, Byron Sharp, one of the things that distorts science is good intentions. And I think, you know, these were very well-intended people who were trying to make the world better. But as you say, there's a world of difference between a Tony's Chocolonely that is built with purpose at its heart from trying to kind of reverse engineer a purpose into a brand that's been around 100 years and, you know, and is selling shampoo that washes people's hair and makes it clean rather than saving third world girls' education. Or, you know, just they're totally different things. And I think, as you said, I think as you hinted at as well, there's often a tendency in marketing that if something works on one thing, it must work on everything. And Dove probably was its own worst enemy on that. Dove is a fantastic brand. There are particular things about Dove that make it particularly good for purpose. I mean, it was a great purpose anyway. But they also have enough money to have a master brand budget, and then they can support products with product messages underneath that. Not many brands have that kind of luxury. So yeah, what's good for one brand isn't necessarily good for lots.
You've been there, and they seem to be prone as a culture to go all in. Like then suddenly every brand needed a purpose at Unilever. And now they go all in on creator and say like 50% of all budgets go into creator. It's like make a media choice. So enlighten us why?
I won't talk particularly about Unilever, but I think that is something that a lot of companies do that, you know, they roll out what works for one brand with another. You do have to try and be very disciplined, don't you, about treating each brand sort of differently in its own sort of respect. But I think there is also with big companies, there is a difference between what they might say publicly and what happens internally. Sometimes you do have to over course correct to kind of push things one way to sort of move the dial, because it's very hard moving dials, isn't it, with big corporations and things. So it's
But with that creator decision, like I wasn't at the table. I'm not very close to Unilever at the moment. But it seems like it's such a strategic choice. And the picture that I had in my head is like a sailor without deciding which harbor he wants to reach to say, I will only sail with this sail.
Yes.
Yeah. And I will set it in this angle.
Yes.
Whatever the wind is and wherever my goal is.
I couldn't make sense of it. Tactics versus strategy, isn't it? Yes. I'm not sure it's quite as extreme as that kind of pronouncement has sort of made, has suggested, really.
It made a splash that. Yeah.
Yes. But I do think, as I said, sometimes these things are said as sort of markers to signify a change of direction that, you know, that over exaggerates it to try and pull companies in certain directions that they perhaps need to go. So let's see. But I mean, the whole creator thing, the jury is very much out anyway, isn't it, on the data of how you make this work in this sort of lots of little world.
I was part of a panel last week at the biggest German marketing conference is the OMR, and there was a creator economy event there, the 9 to 16. I always say it the other way around, this format, 9 to 16 summit because of the format.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting question, like how can you build brands with creators? Because creators themselves obviously are brands. And I think a key thing is you need to be recognized, because otherwise you just build the brand of the creator. And if you don't have the distinctive assets and people don't know that the creator is talking about you, then you have a problem. But I'm sure we come back to that when we talk about distinctiveness.
Yes, exactly.
I know I would like to touch a pet subject of yours, because I think this fits in well. What is brand planning and how we are misled? And I know that you are very interested in how language distorts marketing. And you've said that the words we choose to describe what we do have enormous consequences on how we do it. And you don't think that's pedantic, you think that's crucial.
Les and I, it was interesting when we, because the book that we wrote, How Not to Plan, was, we didn't set out to write a book. It started as a series of articles that we then put together in a book. And when we were sort of looking back over all those articles, it did strike us how often the sort of the choice of word thing came up. Really, it's you wouldn't think words mattered that much when you're talking about kind of marketing and commercial effectiveness, but as you said, they really do matter. Because
can you give an example?
There's lots of different, so the different words can be damaging in different ways, really. So one word that I absolutely hate is consumer, and you won't find that word used at all in the book, right? I never use it, and I don't like any of my planners working with me using it, because it's such a, that choice of word is a distancing word. And if we're trying to get close to people, the word consumer is automatically a kind of a barrier in the way it's defining people by their
function.
Buying
they
habits.
Consume.
Yes,
they
exactly.
consume.
I mean, in the old days, housewife used to, no one says that anymore, but that's a similar sort of. But even Gen Z and these labels are very distancing and unhelpful phrases to use. So that's one thing. Like, you know, just let's talk about people, or, you know, ice cream lovers or whatever we want to call them. But yeah, let's not call them consumers. And then there are words which have kind of embedded faults in them, like sort of things like brand loyalty. We all know that that's kind of wishful marketing. Loyalty isn't really a thing, but I mean, these are words that sound very nice to have. Engagement is another one. Like landing messages. You hear a lot about clients talking about landing messages. I mean, a lot of these things are things that sort of sound like intuitively probably okay, but then you sort of start burying in underneath them, and they really, you know, are not helpful and can be. Driving is another word. I mean,
but can we stick with the messaging? Because that's a word that I hear a lot. Can you say why messaging is so dangerous?
Well, messaging has its role, but it comes back to those two sorts of communication, really. Brand building doesn't need messages as such. Sort of activation often does need messaging, because you're saying, you know, here's a price, or here's a product, or this is what it tastes like, or whatever. But generally, if you think of I'm trying to think of the sort of the great brand building ads that your listeners would listen to. But I mean, things
I can link them. Yeah. If we describe them, that's fine. So
Cadbury's Gorilla or Sony Balls or...
Yeah, people know Cadbury's Gorilla.
That
sort
of thing. I mean, what's the message of Cadbury's Gorilla? Absolutely no idea. There isn't one. But there's a feeling and a set of associations and and something that, you know, my God, it sort of stands out. But generally speaking, you don't need messages as such for brand ads where you're trying to create feelings and associations and emotions. I mean, our famous John Lewis Christmas ads, for example, from Adam and Eve, I'm not really sure what the message on any of those were, really. I mean, they were all based on a positioning of thoughtful gifting. But I think if you did a pretest on them and asked people what the message was, I think people would find it quite hard to put in a sentence what that was. But they would certainly be able to talk about the feelings and associations of sort of Christmas and, you know, the feelings of giving people gifts or whatever, but they're not messages as such, not rational, functional things. And we can get into pretesting later, but, you know, if you don't have a message, you can't, there's no point pretesting on messages because that's not how it works anyway. You know?
But they do deliver on a core motivation during that time, which is connection, for example.
Yes.
And they give that feeling of connection. And Marks and Spencers then become basically a tool for creating these connections.
Yes.
That's so, like, I like to think, you know, I come here from the west of Germany and we're the tool capital of Germany.
Right.
And so I... influences my thinking probably because my great grandfather was a tool maker and everything is around tools. So I think that brand is like a thinking tool. Yeah. It's like, basically it's an offer. It's an offer as a tool. I can do something for you emotionally or functionally. And I think that these kind of campaigns that you just described, they basically hint towards, oh, this could get me closer to something that I want. And if it's excitement with the gorilla, you know, like sensual excitement, or like Marks and Spencer's, the great feeling, the connection, the Christmas time, get into the mood.
Yes, it's feelings and associations and emotions, but not messages as such. And so, I mean, there is a place for messages, but not everywhere.
Let's take another example, performance
exactly,
marketing.
Yes.
You called that the biggest branding success of the last century.
Yes, exactly. And but even words like, Andrew Tindall has done this great work on compound creativity. I mean, that's a genius bit of branding and word use because it sounds so much more interesting and exciting than consistency, doesn't it? Which I think people think just sounds rather dull and boring because nothing actually happens. But compound creativity, now we're talking, this sounds
now
like
we're talking.
Still got creativity and then it compounds. So the things you call things do really matter. And we're very lemming-like, aren't we, in marketing? Everybody copies what everybody else, these all words get embedded in organizations. And generally speaking, I think if we could all just try not to use any words that we wouldn't use in normal life in marketing, we'd all get on an awful lot better, because you just cut out all this engagement driving or ecosystem, all this stuff. It's just, they're all distancing words from real people and how brands really work and how communication really work, which is much more gentle with things like nudging than driving. Just, it's wishful marketing, I would call it.
Yeah, let's just phrase it out. Why performance has been such a great rebrand? Mm. Because what can be wrong with performance?
Yeah,
everybody wants performance, and
do.
It's a rebrand of sales promotion. Mm. And suddenly you are doing performance marketing, and so that was ingenious. And Peter Field recently said, like, one of the things with the long and the short of it, he was suggesting that they might have chosen another word with the long because that needs patience.
Yeah. Yes.
And he said it should be lasting.
Yes.
That's the better word.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I think that's... the other problem with performance is, you know, all the brand building work that isn't performance, inverted commas, sounds like it's not actually generating any sales, which is dangerous as well, because it just makes people undervalue that and feel that's just doing the kind of fluffy stuff and it's only the performance stuff that's actually selling. Yes, okay. Just these words matter. As you say, long and short of it, calling things kind of lasting demand and immediate demand is is a probably better than brand and activation, because again, brand sounds like it's not actually selling anything, it's just doing the fluffy stuff, and it's the activation bit that is. So yeah, the words are really, really important.
Yeah, the words have basically mental models embedded in them.
They do.
So let's turn to that. Like, what is the mental model that helps us to make advertising actually work better? Besides the post-it note.
I'm sure there is a mental model. I mean, there are certain sort of principles of it, like however you define the kind of long and short of it. But that's like the kind of double helix of advertising, really, isn't it? That you do need to understand the kind of the brand building long and the activation, for want of a better word, short. But you know, there are fundamental models like that you need to understand. The 95-5 rule, that you know, only a very small amount of people are in the market at any one time for your brand, but 95% of them are going to be buying it possibly up to a year. I mean, it always staggers clients how infrequently brands are bought by typical buyers. I think, you know, once or twice a year, but people get very confused about that as well. I mean, just sort of general principles. But I think that those are the most important. They are the kind of empirical principles that you need to understand to build advertising on before you get to kind of creative principles, really, about how to be entertaining. And we can probably come on to all sorts of discussions on that with characters and music and all that sort of stuff. But they're the kind of basic principles that you need to know. But I mean, the important thing is also with advertising strategy is a bit like we were talking about earlier, that, you know, there's not one strategy that's right. These are bespoke strategies that you build for all your brands. So, you know, the principles are the same, the long and short of it or whatever. But, you know, as you know, every brand in every competitive situation is different. They all have different histories, different. So, yeah. You know, there isn't really one model of that.
But the one thing that I just take away from this is that the word future demand is very, that we should be in the business of creating future demand when we talk about brand.
Well, sort of lasting demand, but certainly
lasting
not,
demand.
Yeah, not just immediate demand, I think. Because,
right, future also has a weakness, huh? Because it's in the future, but lasting demand, so it immediately creates demand, so tomorrow, but not as strong as the performance, then it compounds, and then we have another word. Yeah. Okay, compounding, lasting.
A good word. Yes,
compounding is great.
That's a good word. Yeah,
that's great.
Good old Andrew Tindall with compound
creativity. Yeah, he's amazing. It's like he's really driving his messages.
He is doing fantastically well. He's very young as well, but he's on fire, isn't he? At the moment, he's doing. So I don't think the guy ever sleeps, but
no, I don't think so.
But yeah, he's doing great stuff, and System One are, you know, doing really very well as well. They're creating lots of new research and helping everybody understand. But weirdly, to go back to Webster, but just so much of it is just, I've done lots of talks with Orlando Wood, and you know, the things that he talks about, which John intuitively knew about the power of jingles, songs, kind of consistency, characters, you know, entertaining catchphrases or slogans, all that stuff. It just, now the science has sort of caught up with all that, but John would have intuitively come up with all that stuff and did sort of 40 years ago.
And that's the big advantage of evidence-based marketing, that things that good practitioners knew, like intuitively from experience, that suddenly you can argue for it in a boardroom, you can discuss it. And I would like to cover a slightly touchy topic, because we talked about research, and many research departments, they have enormous power within client organizations.
Yes.
But many of them are excellent statisticians, but they do not have mental models, from my experience, of how advertising works and how branding is done. And to do this like in an appreciative way, what's the kind of message that they should actually
receive? I think that's right. I mean, some of the great brands at the moment sort of have very successfully built kind of customer understanding into the whole brand without a research department. I think, I mean, you've probably heard a lot of Corey talking at ELF about how, you know, the CEO and the CFO talk directly to customers, and that, you know, there's a direct feedback right into the heart of that sort of company.
No, I haven't heard it. Please enlighten us.
Well, this is ELF Cosmetics.
Yeah.
And that they, and obviously it's a very kind of social led brand. They do, they've got a fantastically short distance between the kind of executive people and their customers. And, you know, they're just constantly getting feedback from their buyers on social and responding with new products. And there's just such an intimate loop. And Corey talked about how, you know, the CFO has been known to get on sort of TikTok and talk direct to customers, the CFO and even the CEO. So, I mean, that's the holy grail. If you can build that sort of customer understanding right into the heart of your company like that, and a lot of companies can't do that, and they do have research departments, some of whom are very good, but yes, some of whom, you know, I do come across them, and you just think that, you know, they do have to know the basics of marketing.
That's what I mean. It's like they're excellent people. They're really hardworking, excellent statisticians. Yes. They do very precise work.
Yes.
But it's like what we talked about, the mental model that they work after often is...
Yes, they don't have one actually. Or they're using kind of phrases which have mental models embedded in them, as we're talking about, like sort of landing messages or whatever, but they've never really acknowledged that there is a model embedded in that, and they haven't thought about what the model should be at that point. So yes, a lot of them do need to be much better trained, I think, in these sorts of principles, and have a sense of the bigger picture and how their research, so it's just not sort of one research project, and but no sense of how it fits into the bigger picture.
Let's start with that. We educate them now, and we talk about a superpower of brands, which you often talked about, which, and we already mentioned, consistency.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Isn't that boring? Why should we consistent? Don't we always need something new, something exciting? The people are bored. You just told us that we should entertain people, and now we show them the same thing again. Doesn't that contradict? Help us.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a great kind of win, I think, in the last sort of couple of years. I mean, largely due to System One, because Les and I wrote an article we probably wrote in 2012, so a long, long time ago, where we were saying that there's no such thing as wear out. You know, wear in is something that you should be more interested in. We talked about an IPA gold paper that we wrote together on Felix cat food, where we talked about how Felix used the same campaign over decades, whereas Whiskers, which was the competitor, chopped and changed around. And we talked about the benefit of, so we've been sort of wanging on about it for ages, but it didn't bite really. People were still talking about wear out. And then I think the kind of System One work, and then Mark Ritson has been really good at spreading this word in the last 2 years. And it does feel like this has really been quite a revelation to people, and people are now understanding it. And compound creativity, that choice of words has been quite a help as well, I think. So now I think clients have got the message, but the thing we need to do now is to try and help people to realize that this isn't the kind of graveyard for creativity that might imply. I mean, it certainly doesn't mean that you just keep running the same ad for years on end. I mean, obviously there are, like, the Coke Christmas ad, you can do that quite successfully, but maybe the sweet spot is what I was talking about at Cannes with Les and Andrew last year, where I talked about disguised repetition, where it's this sweet spot between...
Ah, oh, that's nice. Disguised repetition. Yeah. That's a good word. Well, disguised repetition.
I got it from the music business, because when songwriters write songs, that's what they're aiming for, because our brains, as you probably know, love repetition. Our human brains love repetition, but we only love it up to a point when something starts to feel really repetitive. So what songwriters do is aim for what they call disguised repetition. So you are actually repeating things, but you don't really realize in our brains that they are being repeated. So there's a sort of, it's very pleasing to our brains. And that's what great brand campaigns do. And I've talked at Cannes about Marmite, which is one of our Adam and Eve breeds. We've had 20, I think I said we've been running the campaign longer than Andrew Tindall had been alive. So I think we've done sort of 28 years of it or something. The love, hate Marmite.
What a product. Where's the innovation? Where's the hot new stuff Marmite?
No innovation.
I think there was a packaging innovation you wrote.
Yes, we did. The squeezy Marmite, which is a... And there have been various products over the years, but they're usually done as sort of one-off limited editions. So if you look at the sales chart, you know, there's a tiny bit along the top, which is MPD, but basically it's the same product all that time. The same love, hate campaign that we've done Cannes award-winning work year after year. Creatives love working on that. No one's saying, oh, I'm not working on love, hate, because we've been doing that for 28 years. So that's genius disguised repetition. And to me, that takes creativity of the highest order to be able to do that. Anyone can come up with a creative idea that's over here and something used to be over here. But it takes brilliant creativity to be able to hold some things the same but refresh them as well. And I think Cannes should honor that far more than they do.
Totally agree. Yeah. With my partner Uwe, we always joke that we should create an award, which is like the steady hand on the wheel, like a golden hand on the steering wheel. Yeah. That is going to be the award. And if you think about the situation that I'm not going to use the word consumer. I'm going to say people.
People
are in a volatile world. And if you think of brands, again, as tools, I think they can be tools also to reassure people that some things stay the same.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah? They give this warm feeling.
Yeah.
And you told me when we planned this episode, you told me this great story about Peter Kay, the comedian that did a concert. I would like you to share that story. That's fantastic.
Well, I don't know how much your listeners know about him, but he's a great kind of popular comedian in the UK. And I happened to go to one of his concerts at the O2 Arena. So, I mean, there's sort of tens of thousands of people in there. And one of the things he does at the start of his shows is he plays ads from, well, the 1970s, actually, a lot of them, sometimes the 80s. So we're talking, you know, 40 years old ads. And there are no auto prompts, you know, there's no auto cue prompts or anything. There's no words up on the stage, but so he has literally tens of thousands of people singing along to these jingles from ads from 40 years ago with no prompts at all, and everybody knows the words. I mean, a lot of them are sort of Cadbury's brands and things like that, but yes. And it just struck me how long, you know, how many of the brands we work on now would people be able to sing along to in 40 years time? And maybe we're not thinking enough about staying in culture. We talk a lot about getting into culture, but kind of we are in the business of building memories, and I think we forget that sometimes, and we devalue the things that make things easy to remember, like slogans, jingles, characters. I mean, that's why they all work so well, but we've got slightly sniffy about all those creatively, haven't we? It's like sort of roll their eyes at slogans and jingles. And but, you know, if you look at what teachers use to help kids learn things, it is all repetition, jingles, wordplay, characters. They help us build memories, and we are in that business of building memories. We have to make it easy for people to remember our brands. As I was saying earlier, you know, often they're going to be buying our brand a year from when they see our ads. And yet it comes back to that indifference again. How arrogant that we think people are going to sort of work hard to remember. We have to make it easy for them to remember when they're not interested in our brand, when they buy it in 6 months' time. And I think, again, if you come at it with that perspective, it gives you a very different view on what you need to do creatively to make that easy for your brand to come to mind. They're not going to work hard to remember it. They've got better things to do with their lives. So.
They are busy and lazy.
Yes, yeah.
And but this is so important. Mm. This is really, this needs to sink in. Next time, go to the table when you brief and say, what can we create that people will remember in 50 years?
Yes.
That's the time horizon.
Exactly.
Makes you think a little harder.
I think that's what I found a lovely, I think we all have our favorite Bill Birnbach quotes, but I found one that recently I hadn't seen before. And he said, we all talk a lot about day after recall, but I'm interested in decade after recall. And you think, how much of what we produce today is going to be recalled in decades to come? Probably not very much. So.
And you said jingles work. They're very brain-friendly characters work.
Yes.
And then there's something else that I remember from my childhood. There was also more humor in ads. They were like jokes, and everybody loves to repeat jokes and tell jokes. Yeah. And let's dive into that topic, humor and effectiveness.
It's such an interesting one, isn't it? Again, how, you know, all the science shows that, a bit like characters and jingles, that humor works so well. Yet you look at the sort of graphs, and the use of humor is just gone down and down over time.
Why do you think that is?
I think there are a lot of reasons. I suggest there are a few of them. It's interesting that Cannes have actually reintroduced a humour kind of category as of last year, which is brilliant, because I think what gets rewarded gets made more, which is your point about consistency as well. I think it's important there, isn't it? We need to reward consistency more. But yeah, why is it? I think pre-testing has probably got a bit to answer for. It's much harder to pre-test humour in animatics and unfinished films generally, I think, isn't it? Because so much of humour, well, a lot of types of humour are not very amenable to performing well in an animatic, because you've got, you know, facial expressions, looks, kind of subtle stuff really that is hard.
Timing sometimes.
Yes.
Like a split second earlier it's not funny. A split second later it becomes funny.
Yes. We did the Marmite Gene Project ads that we did 4 years ago. We did actually attempt to pre-test in an animatic, and we did it once and we got an amber, and then we tried again with a different animatic and we got an amber. We just couldn't get it to be funny. And I don't know if you can post the finish film. I mean, they are absolutely hilarious, but they're all based on kind of looks and characters and sort of
which films?
It's called Marmite Gene Project.
Okay, we're going to link that. Yeah, you send me the link and we put it in
It's hilarious, but we couldn't get it to be funny in an animatic. Luckily, we had a very enlightened client who just said, "Look, I know we're not going to get it any better than this in a manic, but I know it's going to be funny." We had James Rouse, who's the director, who's just a brilliant director. And they were hilarious and they work brilliantly well. So that's a good example of, I think, if you had a client who wasn't so enlightened, that would never have made the light of day. So I do think that is an issue. Globalization is definitely an issue. There's a whole lot of humor, like wordplay or whatever, that you can't do when you're trying to make ads that run across different countries. And then you've got cultural sensitivities with certain sorts of humor. It's not a total excuse, because you can get humor that crosses cultures and geography. So, but that's another. The whole purpose thing came about, which was terribly po-faced, wasn't it? And everybody just got very serious about everything. So that's another one. People may be worried about offending people more than they used to, probably. I don't know. You got any views?
Just,
what do you think?
It's just, I totally agree. But let me try something. Ask me two questions. One question, what is my profession? And the second one, what is my problem? Go ahead.
What is your profession?
Actor.
What is your problem?
Timing.
Very good. Very good.
Very simple.
Yes, but you tried testing that. That's not very easy. And then I think of probably just again, that sort of the post-it note syndrome again. I think a lot of clients thought that just it slightly trivializes your brand if you're funny about it, and that it deserves to be treated more seriously, which is like the complete opposite of
I have an intuition that it has to do with how is that going to help us sell. We don't want to be laughed at. We have such serious benefits in our products. And what they don't understand is that the humor is basically the glue that sticks the association in people's brains to make them relevant in future moments when they have a need. And like you said, 95% of people out there, they are currently not in the hunting mode. Mm. So they are in the browsing mode. So humor is basically the sticky tape to stick the right associations into the browsing mode brains to make them choose your brand in the moment they switch to hunting mode. And then suddenly, oh, great.
Yeah.
And so it's basically like if you can explain it, humor makes your message brain friendly, and that is driving sales. is a different pitch from let's entertain people.
I think that's right. But I think there's also more profound roles that humor play when you just go back to what makes us human and why humor has evolved as humans. And
why do you think that is? You are an anthropologist.
There's some of the research show there is a theory that it has evolved to create bonds between people. And if you analyze, there's lots of interesting stuff being done on. Humor isn't about, we tend to think of jokes, but actually, if you watch people interacting and the way that they laugh a lot together, it invariably isn't about jokes and people telling jokes. Laughter is a way of bonding with other people, and people laugh more when they're with friends. They laugh more when they're amongst other people than when they're on their own. Laughter is infectious. It's one of the few kind of mannerisms, apart from yawning, that is infectious. So all these things imply that it does actually have an evolutionary role, and that's all very important and useful for brands, isn't it? Which is all about building a relationship. So humor isn't about getting a laugh in terms of a relationship between a brand and a person. It's about saying, I'm human. I get you. I know that soft cheese isn't the most important thing in your life, but bear with me. I'm going to be communicating. It's a huge bonding mechanism. That's how it's evolved. So it's incredibly powerful in communication, and we should all be using it a hell of a lot more.
That's a good point. Mm. It's like it connects. Yeah, it does connect. And another thing is humor works on the implicit level. And I think that explains why it has become less prevalent in communication, because performance is very explicit. Mm. It's like, here's the offer, this is the advantage, do it now, and look at here. And the unsaid makes things funny. So your brain adds things, and that makes you also own it more. It's like I've done it, I got the solution. There's this little eureka moment that you get it.
Yes.
And that is also, like you said, bonding is like inside jokes, like among friends. Mm. That is something very powerful. If everybody laughs and you don't know what it's about, then obviously you're not part of it.
Exactly. It's a relationship thing, not a kind of cracking joke type of thing. It's very, very powerful. And you're right, when you get at sort of the more sales activate-y sort of end, humor can get in the way. If I just want to know how much something is, or where I can buy it, or how long it's on offer for, I don't necessarily need a load of humor there. It probably could be quite irritating. But if I'm talking about a brand in a way, as you said, that needs to attract my attention, lodge in my brain, give me a warm feeling about this brand that is going to stay with me 9 months until I buy it, then humor is very, very important.
And I have another, I think we can spend the rest of the podcast talking about humor, because there's also, when you make me laugh, I feel like as if you've given me a gift. Mm. It's like something, like a pleasant feeling.
Yes.
And the moment that happens, reciprocity is a deeply embedded principle in our human psychology. So afterwards, I want to give back something, and the minimum I want to give back is attention.
Exactly right. Exactly. It's a contract, isn't it? It's a value exchange. We create communication. We need to give you something, as you say, to earn your attention back. And humor is a great gift to people, and gets
it's a,
you.
It's
on
a
time.
Pity my actor joke didn't land. So
it did. I laughed. There's a reason people put good sense of humor on dating profiles, isn't it? It's one of the most important things we look for in someone else. Because when someone makes us laugh, they get us, and and that's really important for us to feel that a brand gets me. And it's incredibly, and as you're right, I think a lot of clients feel that's slightly demeaning to their. One of my favorite quotes in the book is, I had this client, we worked on this brand called Harvest Chewy Bars. They were sort of cereal bars, and we had ads. We were proposing some ads with squirrels in, where the squirrels would sort of nick the someone sitting on a park bench eating a chewy bar, and the squirrel would come and sort of nick it from him. And this client, this lovely quote, if I ever wrote another book, it'd be the title. He said, "I will not have my fine products endorsed by a rodent," which is... But actually endorsing your products with rodents can be very, very successful. But it was just like, that summed up everything.
I will not have my fine products endorsed by a rodent. That is great. That's great. But that brings us to, that brings us to an interesting topic, to the relationship with clients. Mm. Because you've been in the industry quite a bit and you've seen changes from BMP to DDB to Adam and Eve, now the recent merger with TBWA. What do you think, like, how has the relationship with clients changed? And what do you think, what is important to know, what makes them actually work? Mm. And maybe for the future also, because the industry, I don't know, I'm sure it is the same in the UK, is really changing in Germany. Mm. Everything seems to be happening quite fast in the German agency business.
Well, lots change, but I think probably one of the themes of what I feel about most things is lots change, but actually often the most important things don't really change. And I think the most important things about client relationships don't change, which is the trust, really. There's a sort of truism, isn't it, that behind all great work is a great client, or a great client relationship. And I really do think that is as true as ever. I think a lot of people mistake a good relationship as one being where there's no disagreement ever and it's all about sort of consensus and let's all sort of skip happily along hand in hand. And I don't think that is right. I think you need the sort of trusting relationship that enables you to disagree with trust within that. And I think, yes, so I think that's one of the things that perhaps has changed, that clients are kind of afraid of, and agencies might be afraid of conflict. I don't mean in terms of, you know,
aggressive, but
you do need to be able to disagree with respect and trust, I think. And I think consensus and comfort and coziness gets in the way of getting the best, most effective work out. I don't think you can be in a relationship where you just agree with each other all the time and get that best work out. And long-term relationships are really helpful with that. I mean, I think, you know, project work makes that much more difficult, doesn't it? Because you're only as good as your last project, and then you have to sort of start all over again and build that relationship. But I think, you know, the I was talking earlier, wasn't I, about the trust between planners and clients in the old days. And when you've worked with years with clients, you do build that sort of level of trust. If you look at the clients, the companies and clients and brands that won IPA Effectiveness Awards, big ones last time around, they were very long running client relationships, often with the same clients in place for a long time and the same agencies as well. And I think that's not a coincidence, probably.
Wasn't KitKat something like 55
years?
Yes,
and I think, yes, they've, I think they're even longer than that. But yes, if you look at
6 years.
Who else was there? Well, we wrote one on the Canes, didn't we? We've worked with them for sort of 9 years. There was Yorkshire Tea. I think they've worked together for 9 years. Laithwaite. So, you know, they're just, those long-term relationships are really important, I think.
Yeah, but this brings us back to the beginning of our conversation, like pattern recognition, experience, like what we discussed, like how the planner basically becomes the brain, the memory of the brand.
Yes.
But there's a brutal age discrimination in agencies. Mm. It's like, yeah. So
I'm
basically
doing my best to fight that.
I'm
hanging on in there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But isn't that strange that when you think about it like this, the most valuable people are exactly the most experienced ones working for a long time on the brand, but it's becoming less. Like, the most successful ones are doing it,
yes.
But there, nobody seems to want to copy.
Yes, the economics of the industry sort of, they tend to work against that, I think, a bit. But yes, I mean, the ideal is you have a blend, I think, don't you? You have a department with, you know, lots of young people who've got their different perspectives and some sort of old age wisdom around there as well. You need both, I think, both working together. But I personally feel that maybe this has changed a bit, but I think clients appreciate, with the world in such kind of turmoil at the moment, I think they appreciate people who have lived through a recession before and cost of living crisis and have kind of been about around the block a bit and come out the other side on that and value the kind of opinion and expertise of that. So I think mm-hmm. there definitely is a role for that kind of wisdom too.
Do you have a tip for the younger ones out there, how to build that kind of trust that is longer lasting?
It's a very good question. I think it has to come from not just opinion, I think. I think when I was a planner at BNP, when you were a young planner, you weren't just bringing an opinion to the table, because you'd sat in rooms with your customers and talked to them for hundreds of hours a year. You brought that point of view to meetings, and clients would always respect that. So that enabled you, even when you were a very young planner, to bring something to the table other than just shooting from the hip and saying what you think. So I think the more you can build your knowledge and an informed point of view rather than just opinion when you're younger, the better. Now, you're not going to necessarily do that by having done hundreds of groups, but you know, you can get out there and watch people in supermarkets or ask to go out there with the sales force and just, you know, just bring as much. No client is ever going to, if you say that I've heard your customers say this, or I've watched them buying this, or I've noticed this, you know, they're always going to listen to you because you're going to be bringing a kind of informed point of view to the table, not just a point of view. So, you know, and this is so easy to be able to, or much easier now, to be able to learn from people like Mark or Paul, because there's so much free stuff around. You can just get yourself informed, knowledgeable, and having an informed point of view rather than just a point of view, I think would be my advice.
And what I heard is like, put in the work. It's like, show them that you put in the work.
Yes.
Yes. That you're willing to.
That you care, that you care, that you're knowledgeable, that you're thinking about things or, you know, on their behalf. That I don't like the word passion, but, you know, that you're passionate and interested about their brands. And and clients will always listen to that and respect you. And being able to disagree with that informed point of view, I think, does generate respect. I mean, in the old days when we used to test our own ads, people now would say, "Well, that must be a bit weird, mustn't it? And, you know, how do clients let you pre-test the ads? Aren't you just marking your own homework?" But it was always the case that we were much tougher on our own ads than outside research companies, actually, because we had to live with the results of it. You know, we had to see them go out and then evaluate them. So we were much harsher on them. And actually, there was nothing that built trust with clients more than us saying, you know, it's okay, it's working, but I think we can do better. And, you know, they really trusted you when you said that, when you were being critical on your own behalf.
Right. But maybe there also a different incentive structure would work or would help. Because if the agency would be paid for the duration that an idea is running, and you get more and more money the longer that and it tests well and delivers results, then there's basically a bond. Like, otherwise you have a conflict of interest. The agency is paid for new creative, so obviously they always want to sell you new
ones, or by the hour or whatever.
Exactly, or by the hour. And the other one is about effectiveness. You want to achieve a stronger brand, more sales, higher prices. And
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of room to be much more, I don't mean creative in a sort of, but just much smarter in the way that we are remunerated for things. And I think, you know, the industry is coming to a stage where that needs to change, as you said. I mean, and some of the smaller agencies starting up are obviously experimenting with lots of these different ways of being remunerated. And yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, if consistency is so important and you don't need to be making new ads all the time,
it should be built into the incentive structure.
Yeah, exactly. The longer your ad runs or the longer your campaign runs, you should be remunerated on that rather than, as you say, making something new every year. So, but similarly, you know, clients, everybody's reward systems need to be based on that stuff as well. You know, maybe clients need to be rewarded on the decisions they don't make and the change that they hold to, rather than changing things as well. And again, you know, it's harder to build your profile if you keep things the same than if you're creating new campaigns, isn't it? So these things, the way things are rewarded, do have profound implications for what actually happens, don't they?
Yeah, totally. So we need orientation by knowledge, for example, with this podcast, masterclass in brand planning with Sarah Carter. And then the other thing is that everybody is worried about or is suffering from is complexity. And you are a friend of simplicity.
Yes.
And that's one of the last topics I would like to talk to you about is the clients are drowning in complexity and how can we help them and what should be done and why is it so difficult to achieve to simplicity?
Yeah, I do think one of the biggest roles of planners nowadays is to help find our way. I'm doing the kind of swimming sort of mode here, things just do seem to be getting more and more complex. And I think clients absolutely crying out for, they love when you give them a sort of strategy on a page or a campaign thought that you show simply how it goes through the line and works across channels. And there's a tendency, isn't it called the sort of addition bias or something, where if you ask someone to make something better or improve a recipe or improve an itinerary, our natural intuition is to add an ingredient or add something to an itinerary rather than take things away. And I think as planners, one of our greatest skills and uses to clients is the ability to take stuff away, strip things out and back. And whether that's within a portfolio or within a brand positioning or within an ad idea, the natural tendency with consensus building, collaboration, co-creation-y type client relationships is things just get loaded on, don't they? And you try and cover off different options and build things and and things just get more and more complicated. So we have to really fight to keep things simple because, going back to people's indifference, communications are just not going to work with if they're complex and confusing. And it's very, very easy when you work on things yourself because you know how things work. Because, so often you look at ads and you read what it says in campaign about them and it explains the idea. And then you look at it and you think, oh, that's what it was meant to do.
Okay. Okay. After 36 pages of strategy paper, I understood what the ad meant.
Yes. I think and Mark Ritson has been great on banging this drum as well. They're just things just are far too complicated. Positionings and brand positioning. It's just the general process of workshops and collaboration and co-creation. It's all more people building more stuff into things, and it always comes back to haunt you in the end. You might make someone happy by having their word included here, but it will bite you in 6 months because you'll have come up with something that nobody can sort of see, execute. No one can understand. You ask people what the brand positioning is, and if you've got 10 clients telling you a different one, there's something wrong. But it happens quite a lot of times. Yeah.
That's a good test the listeners can do. It's like you think you are clearly positioned. Go out into the corridor, get 5 people and ask them, what do we stand for?
Yes. Exactly.
And if you get 5 different answers, your positioning is not clear.
Or if you have to just resort to looking at a document to remind yourself as well, then something's very wrong. So
Because this is a good point. Like you were describing, to the outside, we need to make it simple because people are busy and lazy, but also to the inside, because people on the inside of the organization, they don't read strategy papers.
No.
They pretend to read them, but if they read them, they don't remember them.
Yep.
So we need to make it simple to the inside as well, because their behavior and their decisions will shape how the brand turns up on all touch points.
I think that's a really good point that we often forget as well, that we work with our immediate clients, but they have a whole load of other people behind them that they then have to sell into the organization who again, like real people on the streets, don't understand brands or advertising and are not so involved in it. So they need super simple strategies on a page, simple ideas that they can help people in their organization understand and hold on to as well. And nobody ever says that's too simple or can't you make it kind of more complicated. Nobody ever says that. It's always the other way around. So and it comes back to choice of words as well. I think, the words that you choose simple words, short words, simple words, everyday words that we use in real life, not in marketing meeting rooms and boardrooms. And that helps you to keep it simple as well.
Can you have do you have a good example that you can talk about where something was said very complex and then it was reduced to a simple sentence?
Well, not off the top of my head, but I mean, but so much of marketing is just too complicated, isn't it? We talk about, you know, driving sort of eco-friendly Gen Zs along the kind of ecosystem to sort of activate these. What? But just try, if you just top tip, just put it in ordinary language and you can immediately tell if it's nonsense or if it's likely to happen. I mean, people talk a lot about, don't they, about exciting people to get involved and things like that. And you think they're not
engage on eye level.
Yeah,
get into the
not excited. They're not going to get involved with this. But just the more, just try and get out of our marketing land and into real life and. And
kudos indulgent. To Aaron Burke-Bass, who was this distilled like this easy to mind, easy to find. I mean, that's very powerful. That's, in my view, a good example of making something very complex, very easy to remember.
I think easy is just such an important word and we just forget it so much. It is just, I was reading recently about just how our troubled, difficult world with cost of living and all that stuff just is increasing the cognitive load for real people so much that just even more than ever, they just need things to be, we all need things to be super simple just to make our life easier to navigate and kind of keep afloat on, really. And, you know, and how dare we pump out stuff that's just overcomplicated and expect people to try and work their way through it? You know, it's just arrogance. And making things easy is just a really big part of our job, I think.
Yeah, you know that we just talked ourselves into setting the bar very high for the final dash of our conversation. We have to make it easy now.
Oh,
we have to make it easy. Okay, I have one more topic. I love your book, by the way. It's going to be in the show notes. Whoever hasn't read it yet, it's fantastic. How Not to Plan.
And can I just say on the book that the book, any proceeds from the book go to the Account Planning Group, which is the Association for Account Planners. In the UK,
I didn't know that, and it's very cheap. Actually, it's £20.
Yes, I
was surprised how cheap it is.
It's not too expensive, hopefully. But yes, Les and I, we don't make any money from it, so please do buy it because it all helps with training up future planners and that sort of thing as well. So it all goes to a very good cause. So.
Fantastic, thanks. So that was published quite a while ago,
yes,
2018,
it was. Yeah.
And it was like myth busting. Let's pick one. Which you think like you hoped to bust and which is still very destructive today. And then the second part of the question, are there new myths which you would include today if you would do a new edition? Is there something that has come up in the last 8 years?
Well, we didn't talk about purpose at all in the book. And I sort of wish, because it was really at the start of all that and really because it was based on an article which was only 400 words, we didn't think we could do justice on that. And there've been some very good whole books written on purpose since then, so that would have been a myth that we certainly wanted to bust. I mean, I'm sure now we would be probably talking about lots of littles and the sort of danger of lack of scale. I know Les has talked an awful lot about that as well, that we kind of underestimate the amount of numbers and eyeballs that you need to move the dials for sales. I mean, our John Lewis Christmas ads, for example, used to, in terms of impressions, get sort of half a billion to a billion impressions every Christmas, you know, and you need multiple millions to move the scale on anything. And I think people, you know, because these numbers still sound quite big, people say, oh, we got, you know, however many views on some TikTok or whatever, it's sort of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe just rounding errors, really. It's not going to do anything. So, you know, the kind of the myth of these littles is probably a big one as well.
I heard that last week influencer marketing and social media will replace TV as a lead media, for example.
Yeah. Yes, well, certainly not for a long time. Whenever you hear anything's going to replace anything, I always, or anything's going to kill something off or the death of anything, always apply a slightly cynical kind of view on that. Most things don't change quite as fast as people think they're going to. So, So that sort of myth. And then there'd be, you know, the words like driving. I notice everything is just driving this, that, and the other at the moment. I think that's a good word to sort of bust because I don't think anything is quite that powerful in marketing. It might nudge people or encourage them, but it doesn't drive people anywhere really. But so a few of those. In terms of in terms of the continuity and the sort of the wearing thing is massive. I think that has got really profound implications. And we talked about the fact that that consistency is bad, and that you need to disrupt as good. I think that's one of the ones that I certainly would say is becoming more and more important. And that was a big one in the book. And what would be another one?
And what about the topic everybody talks about, AI?
We didn't cover that in the book at all. Well, that would be a whole new podcast, but I think effective kind of emotional communication is always going to involve AI working hand in hand with kind of real people and real ones. I think just it's brilliant AI. None of us know quite where it's going to go or what it's going to do, but basically we're in the business of people talking to people, and our brains are Paleolithic brains, and they haven't changed very much in that time. So the fundamentals of how you communicate haven't changed either. And I think we're always going to need a human brain in there to kind of work hand in hand with AI to effectively communicate. Just as if you're a detective, you might use AI, but you're still going to be walking the streets, talking to people, eyeballing them. If you're an architect, you might be using AI for your plans, but you're still going to be walking a site, feeling the wind. It's just the two will work together. I can't see it replacing humanity entirely in communication, because it's just such a human thing.
I have a good news there. I was at the behavioral science conference here in Germany recently, and yes. I heard this researcher who worked with Gigerenzer, decision science, and he was talking about the complexity of decisions in volatile environments. Yeah. And then he explained chess, AI beats every human in chess.
Yes.
Then in Go, a little bit more complex, took a while longer, still manages to do it. Then he used, I didn't even know it before, a multiplayer online game called StarCraft.
Right.
And then he showed how many variations exist in this game. Until today, an AI only gets to Grandmaster level, and then quite quickly is going down again, because our 20-watt human brain is still much better in dealing with fuzzy logic, in pattern recognition, in highly agile environments, which are complex.
Yeah.
And then I had to think, after I listened to that, it was good news, because I think that brand management is a little bit like StarCraft.
Mm.
There are many, many moving pieces constantly. There are certain principles, obviously, that we talked about that we need to look out for, but you still need that pattern recognition, the judgment, the feeling, the intuition.
Mm.
But then there will be powerful tools, obviously, for things that are just hard labor or work, and they will be done more efficiently.
Yes. Yes.
And maybe it levels the playing field for smaller brands, because they can produce things which used to be very, very expensive. And when they have the right idea and the right judgment, they can produce them.
Yes, I think that's probably right. So yes, all hope is not lost. There's still a role. There's still a role for us planners in there. As long as human beings are kind of messy and flawed and irrational and have kind of a random sort of wonderful tendencies, I think you still need us in there somewhere to communicate effectively with them.
That's a fantastic springboard for our finish. Right. So let's assume all our listeners will forget 80% of what we've discussed now.
Yeah.
I hope they enjoyed it. They had a good time with us.
Yeah.
But what should they remember? The three things that they should remember and just stick. The sticky note. No, it's done. Your
that has to be
don't.
One of them.
That has to be one of them. So only two left. What other two messages would you put on there?
I would say work in advertising, but don't live in advertising. So fight really hard to keep one foot out of it. And so read widely and randomly. Spend as much time as you can trying to appreciate what it's like to not think and behave like you. So I think that would be another one. And then I think I have to have a Bill Birnbach quote in there. And I think given what we're talking about AI as well, that take that wonderful Bill Birnbach quote that, don't get too carried away with changing man, but focus on unchanging man and the things that are going to stay the same because our brains are essentially Paleolithic and they haven't changed and they won't be changing very much anytime soon. So that would be my recommendation.
So be fascinated by the unchanging
yes,
man.
Yes.
And that leads us to the brand code of Markenkraft, which I still have to ask. Is like you have the chance to put a screensaver question on the smartphone, on the laptop, on the desktop. That it can be just a word, it can be a quote, it can be just a picture. Mm. What would you put on there for all the people out there responsible for brands?
Indifference.
Indifference is a word.
Mm.
Indifference. Remember.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That's fantastic, Sarah. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for this conversation.
I enjoyed it.
I'm going to try to make a short summary. That the starting point, what I learned is that it's not the strategy document, but not the data dashboard, but like the sense of humility that you just said. Yeah. Like
yes.
Remember the indifference of the people out there, the acceptance that people do not care as much as we do about our brands.
Mm.
And that's liberating. That's what I learned as well. It's not to put people down, but it's liberating and makes you help doing better work. Then the second thing is you need to stop lecturing and start entertaining because that's brain friendly. Yeah, use more humor. Be bold, like characters. They are out of fashion and they still work fantastic for the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned that words, they shape our decisions. That
yes.
words matter.
Yes, very good.
Mm. Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you again,
Sarah.
Very
good summarizing.
This was wonderful.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Und das war's für heute. Vielen Dank, dass ihr dabei wart. Wir hoffen, es hat euch genauso viel Freude gemacht wie uns. Wenn ja, empfehlt Markenkraft euren Freunden, euren Bekannten, euren Kollegen und hinterlasst eine Bewertung. Es hilft enorm, dass andere diesen Podcast auch entdecken. Share the love for brands. Macht's gut für euch selber und die Menschen in eurem Leben.